believe in this book as much as any man. And just like any man, I wrestle with my conscience. But what do you do when everything you value in this world is under attack?
I don't know, sir. I ain't got answers to questions that big. But I also feel like my values are under attack. And I don't know why.
I don't give a rat's ass about your principles because the Japs don't. If one of them attacks you and some wounded soldier, what are you gonna do? Hit him with your Bible?
I'm prepared to give my life for my men.
You don't win wars by giving up your life. Look, I'm only here because I don't want to see you rotting in a prison cell. Plead guilty. Throw yourself at the mercy of the court. Maybe they'll let you go home and pray. Let the brave men out there go and win this war. If I can't convince you, maybe she can.
They wouldn't let me call you.
I knew it wasn't your making.
What have they done to you?
It's okay, I'm all right. Just went a couple of rounds with the wall and lost.
They're saying you could go to prison, Desmond. Leavenworth. There must be some other way.
I don't know what that could be. I've done everything they asked me except this one thing. I'm being treated like a criminal just because I won't kill.
And you tried. Nobody can say you didn't. Who are you going to save in prison?
Probably nobody.
And why can't you just pick up the stupid gun and wave it around? You don't have to use it, just meet them halfway.
Thought I can't do that.
Yes, you can. It's just pride. Pride and stubbornness. Don't confuse your will with the Lord's.
I'm prideful. Maybe I'm prideful. But I don't know how I'm going to live with myself if I don't stay true to what I believe. Much less how you could live with me. I'd never be the man that I want to be in your eyes.
I fell in love with you because you weren't like anyone else and you didn't try to be. Do not think for one moment that you'll disappoint me. I will love you. I don't know what he's going to do.
All right. There it is. How many folks have seen the film? Look at that. That's what our filmmakers love to see. Great. Well, welcome. My name is Craig Detweiler, and I'll be your host every afternoon this week, 2:30 to 3:15. We're going to talk to three different sets of filmmakers, find out behind the scenes how they brought these kind of amazing pictures to life. And so today we're going to talk about Hacksaw Ridge. But this is part of a larger movement of what I think God is doing here in Hollywood through unlikely people and unlikely means. You may have noticed if you've been watching TV, you know, things like Morgan Freeman doing The Story of God. It was so popular, it got renewed for a second season. If you listen to the radio, you got Carrie Underwood singing Jesus Take the Wheel, or you got Kanye West singing Jesus Walks. God's speaking through families, right? This Church of Christ family, right? We know about the Robertson folks on Duck Dynasty, but you also have folks on Black-ish going to church, talking about faith on their show. And, of course, what TV family goes to church more than any others? The Simpsons, of course. The Simpsons. So all of this is part of the work that I do here. My name is Craig Detweiler. I'm a professor of communication here at Pepperdine University. And these are the kind of books and research that I do, helping students find God in pop culture, as well as helping them become better storytellers. And my research has extended out now to looking at the small screen as well, right? That has such an intense relationship for young people. And so my latest book, iGods, is about how technology is shaping our spiritual life. So we're going to spend this afternoon, we're going to have a chance to talk to the producer of Hacksaw Ridge. Tomorrow we're going to talk to the producer of The Shack. And we're going to have a couple of guests who are also part of the conference here, John Mark Hicks, as well as Greg Taylor, are going to talk about how the Shack has impacted their faith community. And then on Friday, we're going to talk about the film Silence, which very powerful real-life story of martyrdom and missionaries and faith in Japan. But for now, we're going to start with my guest today directs something called the Shea Foundation in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And he did a documentary called The Conscientious Objector about a real-life war hero named Desmond Doss. And that became the basis and the starting point for this powerhouse film that's been nominated for Golden Globes. It's won Oscars. And so I'm really, really honored to have a chance to talk to you about Hacksaw Ridge. David Greathouse, the executive producer, is also a Pepperdine grad, and he was hoping to join us. He ended up in jury duty, of all things. So he's serving the community, doing his part. But Terry Benedict, who was with the project from the beginning, is here today. So let's give him a big hand. Welcome up, Terry Benedict. So, Terry, you're actually a Pepperdine grad. Look at you wearing your orange and your Pepperdine pride. I love that.
This is actually new. You know, it's by design to look all crinkled and old.
I love it. So you actually majored in film here at Pepperdine?
Film wasn't here. You know, the...
Is this on?
I don't know.
It may not be.
I can use my Shakespearean training that I got here at school.
There we go. That's better.
You know, I didn't grow up wanting to be in the film business, and my cousin worked for Dr. Bailey, the baby heart surgeon at Loma Linda that put the baboon hearts in babies. And he said, look, why don't you come out here and be a real doctor? So I said, okay, and went out there. And then what I ended up doing was I got bored and wrote a treatment for Starsky and Hutch.
Oh, nice.
And I was so naive, I didn't realize the show was in syndication. So I sent it in to a friend of mine, took it and sent it in. I didn't even know how to type. My mother typed the treatment for me. I wrote it out in longhand. And so some people got a hold of me and asked who I was, and which I was nobody, obviously. And they said, well, listen, why don't you let us set up 3 interviews for you at UCLA, USC, and Pepperdine? And I had never heard of Pepperdine. So I went to USC, saw where that was, went to UCLA, and then when I'm driving out Malibu Canyon Road and went past the house was the castle, you know, it's not there anymore. And then I said, wow, this is pretty nice. And I'm a California boy. I was born in Loma Linda. And they got my attention. But then it was one of the chair of the theater department at the time found me on a tour, and he said, if you want to go to school here, he said, you'll never pay a dime.
Oh, that's a good deal.
So I went here on a full ride, and nice. He just, it was an act of God, really, because he took it on just something he saw. He took it on a leap of faith or trust or something, but that's how I ended up here.
That's beautiful. Isn't that great? So this is your chance to give back.
I have been giving back a long time now.
We believe you. So amazing picture. The audience has seen it. They loved it. Powerhouse performances, and yet people don't, maybe when they realize, you know, when they got to the theater, they didn't realize this was actually a true story, right? This is you know, an actual war hero who you had the opportunity to sort of meet and befriend. And how did all that come together?
Well, my parents were genius enough not to allow a television in our home until we were 12 years old. And so we had to do something besides play kick the can, so I read a lot, and I read very voraciously, and I found this book about Desmond in the library because I was 10 years old, reading through the, sort of the war canon, like 30 Seconds Over Tokyo and Guadalcanal Diary, Pearl Harbor series, of course, and I came across this book, and it was unlike any other war hero I had ever heard about, read about, And it just sort of caught my imagination. And then a couple of years later, when I was 12, I was going to a church summer camp, and Desmond was at this camp. Mm-hmm. And he really had this burden for sharing and helping kids set their moral compass. And so it was obviously really impressionable. And then I didn't reconnect with him until the late 90s, well into my film career, and met him at a couple of Medal of Honor reunions. And then that's really where our relationship developed into, he was, became sort of my surrogate grandfather, really.
Wow. So you're both a part of the Seventh-day Adventist tradition?
Yeah, I was raised as an Adventist.
Yeah. So basically, years later, after sort of reading this biography, how did you then approach Desmond and say, I want to tell your story, I want to make a documentary about your life?
Well, it's a fantastic story. What I didn't realize at the time was Hollywood had been chasing him since 1945 when he got the medal, and he wasn't going to let that happen. His two primary concerns were, one, he didn't want to be glorified. He wanted that honor to go to God, and then he was worried that Hollywood might spice up his life, like that would happen, right? I developed my relationship with him. I said, Desmond, look, your Medal of Honor citation reads like a big fish story, and nobody's going to believe it after you kick the bucket. And we really should do a documentary. And I had never done a doco before. I was actually probably a little bit too snobbish to do that, even though my first job in this town came from being a lifeguard at the Pepperdine Pool. And
you can meet a lot of people at the Pepperdine
Pool.
Yeah, you
can, actually, yeah. You know. And I was a lifeguard at Colony Beach at the same time, too. And but Haskell Wexler, an Academy Award-winning cinematographer, worked. He was part of the Crest Club, worked out at the pool. His producer, Roxanne McCann, also did. And I got to know them. And Haskell, of course, was a living legend in terms of being a doco filmmaker as well as a DP.
And director of photography.
Yeah, he did Medium Cool about the 1968 Democratic Convention. It's part of the documentary canon, actually. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't, and I learned a lot from him. So I convinced Desmond, we really need to think about this, and he kept going over these concerns, and we're in the parking lot of this little grocery store outside Chattanooga. And he brought it up again, and I said, look, I know you're really concerned, but here's what I can promise you. I'll answer to God first, you second, and everybody else can get in line. And he let out a big laugh, and he said, okay, you can do it. And so that's what started the doco.
Wow. So it was really just a commitment on your part to protect his story, and to make sure that it wasn't sort of compromised along the way.
Right.
Here he is. This is, I don't know what age he is here, but still being celebrated. How long did he lived?
86, 87. He died in 06, and he was born in 1919, so you guys can do the math. Hmm.
So he didn't get to see the finished film, because the finished film took a little bit longer to come together than...
Well, you mean Hacksaw?
Yeah.
The doco,
yeah,
he saw.
He got to see Conscientious Objector.
Yeah, so we were at the world premiere at Cinequest up in San Jose. It was ranked number 10 in the world in 2004. And we were the closing night gala event. And you know how, the filmmaker does, doing the Q&A after the show, and the place was twice oversold. And we just had won our first awards, but nobody had seen the film yet. So they saw the film, and they were really overwhelmed by it. So they were saying, well, what's Desmond really like? I said, well, I don't know. Why don't you just ask him? He's sitting right here in the front row. And it's the first time he'd ever been in a movie theater before. So
you compromised his morals to get him into this.
I did. I totally did. and they went to the place, the house went crazy. I mean, it was bedlam.
A living legend, right?
Yeah.
A literal war hero right in front of him.
It was amazing. It was, you know, that was one of the highlights I'll take to my grave with me, literally. But and so then we started what I thought was going to be a pretty short development phase for Hacksaw. And I started pitching it around town to some producers and studios. And there was a lot of interest. In fact, a couple of companies wanted to make a deal right then and there. And then I had met Bill Mechanic, who was the former president of 20th Century Fox. Mm-hmm. And hit it off with Bill and really felt like Bill got the essence of the story and the worthiness of it and also the need to protect the integrity of the story. So that's...
But that...
And
still
plus, I thought Bill was going to, like, deliver, you know, like, in a year or
right
two.
Away, right away, right, yeah.
So which he did go ask Mel, you know, all, right off the bat, and Mel said, no, pass, you know. And then we started a 12-year journey.
12 years.
Of development.
12 years. That is a lot of faith on your part to continue to pursue this, right? To not give up hope, to sort of say, okay, we've got a script, but we're still waiting on money, we're still waiting on a green light. Were there times where you were tempted to let it go and just say, give up, it's not going to work? This is...
No, you know, I always trusted Bill, and Bill was the primary producer. He carried did all the heavy lifting during that this whole phase into the film. And you know, if you make a decision and you're living your life in a way that, I know this is probably going to sound a little odd or maybe even controversial to some, but you know, God, when God says, hey, you know, I want you to trust me, there's this other word that comes along with that we never talk about, and that is letting God be accountable and even making God accountable. I mean, if he says trust, then if you look in the thesaurus, you start finding words that start talking about that kind of thing, which sounds a little arrogant. I don't mean it that way, but you're either going to trust and let him be accountable or you're not. I mean, so yeah, it was a challenge going through that and wondering what's going on, you know. But now, I mean, Bill and I had a conversation about this at his office a couple of months ago that when you look back on it and when I look at the other actors that rotated through, the other directors that rotated through and that sort of thing, timing's everything, and, you know, I'll be the first to admit, I don't really want to live on God's time. I want to live on my own. And so I think that the film and all the elements of the film came together at the most perfect time, and the film is already a classic.
No, and Andrew Garfield, so strong in this film. We'd seen him, you know, maybe in Spider-Man, right? But I don't think we understood that he had the depth to carry out this kind of role. Did he have a chance to meet Desmond, or how did he? I mean, he's British by background, right? Or American British.
Right.
So I mean, he's not from the South. How did he get that accent? How did he sort of take in this faith? I think he's Jewish by background, right? So he's maybe not familiar with the Christian faith as expressed in sort of the American South. How did all that come about?
Well, I brought Andrew down to Chattanooga. Desmond lived his whole adult life on Lookout Mountain above Chattanooga, and so I brought Andrew down and took him to where Desmond had lived, and Desmond's buried there at National Cemetery. I should have actually brought this picture. I took this really nice picture of Andrew sitting at the gravesite. He had really long, shaggy hair at the time, but he was really inside himself, you know, really just sort of meditating. And then we did a road trip up to Lynchburg, Virginia, and that's where Desmond grew up, and took him to everywhere that I. In fact, if you see the documentary, I took him everywhere where Desmond was in his local hometown there, including Desmond liked to put pennies on the train trestle rail and watch the trains flatten them, and so I took him there and we walked the rails and we just had a really good time together, and he's a very reflective actor. He's a method actor, mm-hmm. which means, you know, it's all about the process,
mm-hmm. From the inside out,
from the inside out. Yeah. So it all has to be legitimately there, and then we went through, of course, the documentary and things like that. But what's really great is when you see the documentary and then you see the Hacksaw, you'll see this sort of seamless transition of just how close Andrew comes to Desmond for real. And you do see a little bit of it at the end of Hacksaw when you see some of the clips of the doco there. But Andrew and the rest of the cast, one of the brilliant things Mel did was he showed the documentary before filming started. And it was really the catalyst to bring everybody together. Because on a film, you have 200, maybe even 300 people on a crew, cast and crew. For myself as a filmmaker, I always talk about it in the terms of doing what's in the best interest of the child, meaning the film. And everybody needs to work together to that end and sacrifice, do whatever it takes, because that's where you come out with a great product. And Mel's an extraordinary filmmaker and also for sure knows that better than anybody. And so the CO really set the stage and the tone for that.
Beautiful. I love the cast. I mean, capturing the spirit of his wife, the drill sergeant, his dad. Such a variety of characters in this film. And to have Mel Gibson back in the director's chair, that's somewhat unusual, right? It had been a long time.
Yeah, 9 years.
Yeah. How did he come into this project? And the project, a lot of people may not realize this, it actually was shot in Australia.
Yeah, the whole thing was in Australia. That's another thing. I mean, that was the last place probably I ever would have thought that we would have done the film. Originally, I thought, there's plenty of places in the Philippines. I've been to Okinawa several times, which it couldn't happen there. But there were reasons for that. Screen Australia funded a good portion of the film, so there's not just strings, but big fat ropes that come attached to that. And you hope that it doesn't overly compromise the vision. But Mel, kudos to him because he really pulled it off. And the crew and the team of people, again, when I got onto the set, it was pretty amazing because everybody, you can go on sets and there's always sort of dynamics. I mean, you know how it is in the workplace. You know, everybody kind of has their little territory and, there's certain lines you don't cross and all of that. But everybody was working in a very harmonious way from all of the picks I ever worked on. I mean, this was very, very peaceful. And it was really a joy to do that.
That's very rare and tough when you're doing a war picture, right? You've got all these action scenes, things blowing up, special effects. This is not, this is dangerous stuff that you're undertaking here.
Yeah, those are all real effects. That's not CGI stuff.
That's scary.
In fact, if you're standing near the camera, you could feel the heat from the flames. I mean, those flamethrowers.
I guarantee you. So you were on the set. You actually went to Australia. You were there.
Yeah, that picture was 104 degrees out. So that's our little producer's tent there. And so we would watch, what was being shot at that point, that moment, if we didn't want to be up on the set. That was about, in fact, you can see sort of that hill behind there a little bit. That was the battlefield. So we're probably 100 yards off the off the set there.
So is it a little like going to war, or how does this work when you're playing soldier?
Yeah, that's Luke Bracey. He played Smitty. He's the character. Does anybody care about spoiler alerts in this room? No, right?
They've seen it. Everybody's seen it. A lot of people have seen it.
Okay. So Smitty plays the character that, busts up Desmond, and then you fall in love with him. He falls in love with Desmond at the end. I don't know why that made me emotional all of a sudden.
Well, because you lived through this, right, with these people.
Anyway, Luke is a super nice guy. He's actually going to get involved with my nonprofit that I have because his girlfriend, we do work in Nepal and sex trafficking. But so my daughter, who wants to be a veterinarian and come to here to go to school, at least for pre-med, she likes gross stuff. So I said to Luke, I said, let me take all these pictures of you shot up so I can send to her. So this is right after we killed Luke up on the cliff.
Grizzly. Big crew, lots of fun dressing up, and yet you have these long, probably night shoots right?
Yeah.
This is a trying time. How many days was the shoot?
It was 60, a little over 60 days with some pickups and stuff.
That's a long time.
Plus we had second unit going along at the same time, But this is the escarpment. This was an old quarry. But the real escarpment in Okinawa was actually made up of coral rock, and it was deadly. Even when I was there, you'd slip on it, you'd cut your skin like a razor blade. Even now, and so if you can imagine, 2,500, 2,000 pound naval shells bombing every night on top of that ridge, and even back then, you know, they didn't have computers, you know, tossing those bombs that weighed as much as a Volkswagen. So sometimes one or two would fall short and, you know, fall into the guys. So there was friendly fire that he had to contend with, and yet all of that shelling didn't do anything to the top of that ridge. There were 15,000 Japanese soldiers, a whole division, in that cavern. There were whole tunnels and everything down in there, including comfort women. They didn't have to come out for 30 days. So it was, I know that's not the place, but that, by the way, that's 125 feet, and that was about the height of the cargo net part. And then you see that angle down there. That would have been not, in reality at Hacksaw, that would have been another 375 feet at a 45-degree angle. So they had to climb that to get to the cliff part, and then go straight up.
Herculean effort. I noticed this shot. You've got the is this the Bible?
Yeah. I took this in the tent that you saw earlier. Desmond, his wife saved everything, absolutely everything. She was a pack rat, to her credit, for me as a filmmaker. So I mean, it was amazing that what things I would find. This is the one thing I never found, because in 1969, Desmond went back to Hacksaw, and somebody stole this Bible out of his car. And so that has never been seen again. So it just reminded me of that story, so I popped this picture in.
I love this scene where they're getting ready to make the charge. And Desmond is sort of on a different wavelength, right? Everybody else is gearing up for battle, and his way of gearing up for battle is to take a moment and to pray.
Pray, right?
Yeah.
He did that. Yeah. 2 days before this, the most accurate record of what happens on the battlefield is what they call the after action reports, and that's a daily journal essentially at the end of the day of what's happened. And so I was at the National Archives, excuse me, and I wanted to see those after-action reports. To me, that was the most important thing in the DACO part, because I didn't want to stick my neck out there and start telling fish stories. I really wanted to know what the truth was, and I needed those after-action reports. So a senior archivist found them for me, and I was amazed because, and you can see this in the doc, because I scan the pages, but it says in there three times that on three separate occasions that Desmond, before they went up, he prayed for the company. And on the third day, which was May 5th, which was the Saturday, this part you see in the trailer, if you've seen the movie of What the Hell Are You Waiting For? We're waiting for Doss to pray. That's in the after-action report. All of this is Hacksaw is based on the documentary, because there was no story besides reading Desmond's Medal of Honor citation, which you can't go by that, obviously. So that's one thing I'm really proud about, that we were able to uncover the color of Desmond's story and what these men went through. It wasn't just Desmond, but what these men went through.
Let's talk a little bit about the reception. You've been talking to, I think, veterans groups, and you've had all kinds of private screenings. You had a premiere at, I think it was Venice. What's this journey been like in sort of getting his story in front of audiences? What have been some memorable moments and screenings and reactions?
Well, I sort of lost track of how many previews I did. I know we did, I probably did it, I don't know, a dozen to two dozen, and then countless interviews. And each one of them was really unique. But there was this common theme, and I think one of the ways to have a successful film is you want to find universal themes that people can relate to. So whether it's this thematic of everybody's found love and lost love, in the context of why we're here in terms of everybody's talking about wanting to make a faith-based film. I don't want to make a faith-based film. I want to make a film that has elements of faith in it, but I want it to be a bridge to the world. I'm not interested in preaching to the choir, so to speak. And that's what Hacksaw is. It's not a faith-based film. It's about a man of faith who demonstrates in a very practical way, you know, what he believed in. And so for me, doing those previews and count these interviews and whatnot, it always came back around to how did he do what he did? Because we all try to figure out how to aspire to be like him. And that was kind of the whole reason why I wanted to see Desmond's story told, was because when we think about heroes, earthly heroes especially, we always want just, I think, an easy recipe to follow. Just give me the steps and I'll make it. You know, I'll show you my works, you know. I'll just go do it. And that's not usually the way life works. And the thing that Desmond wanted to get out, and he and I talked a lot about this, was that for people that have faith, that they should take great comfort in the fact that no matter whether it's the good, bad, or the ugly, that your faith will always carry the day. And then for those that don't have that lifestyle, that maybe you might want to think about obtaining that lifestyle.
So I love the fact that you carried the story for all those, you know, a decade or more, and yet you needed money to actually make this film, right? That was one thing that was holding you back. And here you are at the premiere standing beside a Pepperdine grad who provided a huge chunk of the funding, and you didn't know that you both went to Pepperdine.
It's terrible, isn't it?
That's David David Greathouse, right? Who's a Church of Christ kid from Texas who came out here and is now producing. Yeah, he was a theater major here and now producing film.
Yeah, in fact, we met 5 minutes before that for the first time. David's a great guy. David is president of Demarest Films, and he convinced his boss, who finances the company, that they should go all in on this project. There was never going to be another opportunity like this for such a great story, a great filmmaker, a great package around the filmmaker. And so David got the green light and then worked it out with Bill. And it wasn't an easy process because Screen Australia, like I said, funded a major portion of the film, like 40%, and there were 30 countries pre-sold, so each one of those countries had a financial contract. David really, you know, brought things together in a way that, and working with Bill, that all that has to come to the point where money has to exchange hands for something to happen. So,
which is another miraculous side of the business when that actually happens.
I mean, we're good about having great creative conversations, you know, and I just came from one downtown in Malibu, and it was a great conversation, actually, with Vince. Are you in here? Oh, okay. So Vince Buddha is one of my new producing partners, and Vince is an alumni from Pepperdine.
Nice. So here we go again. Look at that. Go Waves.
So just a quick little promo, by the way, because it doesn't end there. So David Brookwell, who also went to Pepperdine, he produced Soul Surfer. And so David's one of our partners. And then Steve Aaron-Guerin, who worked for Disney many years, who was Senior Executive Vice President of Disney Global Animation. I can't even believe how you fit that on a placard, actually. But that was his title.
Yeah.
So he's our fourth partner. And we all bring together particular emphasis. Vince comes on the financial side, Steve on the development side, David on the production side, and I I'm a director, producer, writer sort of dude. So and the name of our company is Rogue Wave Entertainment.
Nice.
So we try to play it back a little bit to school here.
Good job, Wave. Three global Golden Globe Awards. You got BAFTA Awards, 6 Academy Award nominations, and there you are on the red carpet. Was that the plan all along? You're like, yeah, I'm going to the Oscars.
I can't plan that far ahead. That's David, and the guy in the middle is actually Desmond's son, Desmond Jr. Mm-hmm.
It's amazing to me. I mean, what a ride. You had such a wild ride. Here you are with Mr. Vince Vaughn, Mr. Mel Gibson. Here's, your sound team, which won the Oscar, your editing team.
That's Kevin in the middle.
Won the Oscar. You made your money back. You might have even made a little profit, which is a miracle in this town when that happens. This had to have gone so much further than you would have maybe imagined. Or did you, or could you see that it would be embraced and loved in this way?
No, it. I knew it would, because that was just sort of my 10-year-old faith part of it, you know. But I know I'm a perfectionist, and I think that it performed. It actually overperformed for what people thought.
Absolutely.
I think that it set a new standard of excellence for inspirational storytelling in a lot of ways, and that's what actually brought me and the guys together, because we decided that since we all share the same values, that I don't want to step down. I want to continue, climbing that mountain. And I was back east doing a thing like this, and somebody said, "Well, what's it feel like to have achieved everything you ever dreamed of?" And it's like, well, I never thought it was a destination. It was always a journey. I have to go make another film, so it's no vacation time.
And that's right.
And part of that is because it's not just about making another film. It's about wanting to touch people's lives and impact and hopefully cause them to reevaluate or realign maybe what they're going through, and to be able to come away and say, listen, if a guy like that could make it, maybe there's hope for me. Mm-hmm.
Very hopeful film. Comments, questions, thoughts from the audience. What would you like to hear from Terry? He's giving us some good behind the scenes.
This will be the first time nobody's had a question.
Right here. Can we see the documentary, Conscientious Objector?
I don't know when the Blu-ray's coming out, but you can download off Amazon the standard def version. Which, by the way, it was the first feature-length documentary to be shot in the Panasonic high-def format, the Vericam format. I was lucky enough to be sponsored by Canon and Panasonic during the pioneering of the high-def age. So it's really
it's
the first feature-length doc shot in high-def.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Period. Another question?
When the DVD comes out, the backbone, are you going to have a comment track?
Me personally? No.
Actually,
the Blu-ray's
it's out.
Already out. There is a behind the scenes.
Behind the scenes.
Yeah.
But does it have your story and the backstory that people were after him in 45 and you got the picture? That's a big deal.
You know what? Honestly,
you got the exclusive story right here today. Yes. That's what just happened.
Yeah, Bill tells the behind the scenes story. So, and I actually haven't sat and watched it.
You've been busy.
I'm at my paying gig right now is writing a screenplay that I've got to get done.
There you go. Yes. So how was the film received by broad audiences? Yeah.
Well, I think the box office really represents that because just the Christian world itself could not carry that kind of box office. So that's not to be smart about the answer, but that's part of it. And then the other part is, for over a decade, I have gotten phone calls or emails every week of my life from people that, for a long time, obviously on the dock, but now on Hacksaw, that find a way to get a hold of me, and all they want to do is say thank you. And they're not, you know, they're not necessarily believers.
And the film's just really starting on Blu-ray, right? There'll be a whole other audience that discovers it that way. Yes, sir.
So what's next?
What's next?
Well, I haven't been talking about things specifically, but the story I'm writing right now is actually a social justice story, and it's a story that about a man who was innocent and was executed in the state of Georgia for a crime he didn't commit back in 2011. A black man convicted of killing a white cop in a rush to judgment, and he was a believer, and he went in the most Christ-like way when they executed him, including literally laid out like a cross and forgiving his executioner. Very inspirational story, even though I don't want to get off in the weeds, but when the night of his execution, I was there. I was supposed to be his witness. And so a lot of this is unfortunately autobiographical, which isn't easy for me necessarily to write, but Hollywood was calling me, texting me when, hey, isn't this the guy you've been working on a doco on? And is it, you know, and I had gone around to studios and no, this is, including even a couple of that you would know why they exist, like Inconvenient Truth kind of things, and say, well, this is really a domestic story, we're really international. It's like, well, no, this is international because the Pope, Desmond Tutu, Mandela, the EU, all were advocating on Troy's behalf. Hmm. And so it's a wild story, but it's a story. And the reason why I'm putting myself through this to get it out, because the way the story's coming out, when I pitched it at Warner Brothers, a couple other places, they wanted it to include my relationship. And it was because Troy was such an inspiration to all the people around him. You know, you talk about reading in Paul, singing in prison kind of thing. Well, that's Troy. He was never downbeat. And I think that it's easy for us to be people of faith and kind of waltz through life. But just imagine sitting your whole adult life knowing you didn't do something and you got arrested and convicted at the age of 18 or 19 and leading all the way up to your final being executed when you're age 40, 41 and trying to stay positive through your whole adult life.
Hmm. Let's hope it doesn't take 10 to 12 years.
Vince is going to make sure that doesn't happen.
That's beautiful.
6 months, he says.
All right, we have maybe time for one more question here and then there. Yes.
The Shea organization.
Shea, tell us about the Shea Foundation.
Shea is Old Gaelic. It's my daughter's middle name, actually. It means gifted and learned. When I did the documentary on Desmond, some people much wiser than me came to me and said, listen, you need to start a nonprofit. And I said, why does the world need another nonprofit? And they said, well, because there's people that need storytellers out there that can help other nonprofits that don't know how to tell their story, and there's a lot of causes out there that need to be have the awareness raised. So I started wrestling with that. I didn't know I was necessarily called to do that for a long, long time. And finally, the lightning bolt hit me, and so I, with a couple other people, I wanted to test things out because I didn't, again, want to stick my neck out there and try something and say, oh, this is going to work great, and then it doesn't. But we tested out 6 projects, and including, like I said, sex trafficking, addiction recovery. All of the projects that we've done, we've raised millions of dollars for, and we have like a 10x ROI for the type of stuff that we do. So And one of our secret sauce is simply creative professionals. We could go stand in the soup line, you know, and for the day, but it's not terribly gratifying, you know, in the sense of using our giftedness. And so I really, you know, prayed about that and wanted to figure out, because we also can't spend a year of our lives working on a project either. So our secret sauce ended up being we have a strong mentorship program so that gifted students come and work under our tutelage, and they aren't getting us our coffee. They're cutting, you know, they're editing, they're shooting, but we're also right there with them modeling all of that. So the products that we can create can compete and for anything that you would see out there where people pay our fair market value kind of thing. So that's what Shea does, and we're just now coming out of the mom and pop and going into the big enchilada thing.
Last question from the back row.
Yeah,
how did the faith elements work with the director and the actor?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's always important to have a good relationship between the filmmaker and his all of his actors. And Mel, being an actor himself, understands the language and understands the art. And obviously, like you said, being a believer, understands the messaging. So all of that played in, and that's why he really was the right filmmaker.
Yeah. Terry Benedict, Hacksaw Ridge.
Thank you.
Thanks, Pepperdine Bible Lectures. Thanks, Terry. We want to see more. We want to see more.